What if financial analysis is the key to making informed management decisions? Understanding its principles can significantly enhance strategic planning and operational efficiency. By exploring key concepts, you'll gain valuable insights that can drive success. In this chapter, we'll uncover the fundamentals of financial analysis and its application in real-world scenarios. Today, we will explore how to understand the integration of financial and non-financial disclosures. You'll master profitability ratio analysis, focusing on real-world scenarios. Next, we will learn to analyze turnover ratios for informed decisions on resource management. We will evaluate liquidity and solvency to assess financial health effectively. Finally, you will identify and interpret financial trends from multi-year data to enhance performance insights. As we delve into financial analysis, it stands out as a systematic evaluation of a company's performance and future potential. The foundation rests on core sources, the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow statement, which capture essential financial data. Key dimensions of analysis include stability, solvency, liquidity, and profitability, reflecting a company's overall health. However, financial assessment goes beyond number crunching. It incorporates ESG metrics and sustainability disclosures that are increasingly vital. Understanding these aspects informs stakeholders' decisions by integrating insights, enhancing strategic evaluations. The modern role of ratio analysis reveals its significance in financial insights. Ratios matter because they present key information about liquidity, solvency, efficiency, and profitability in a clear format. For investors and shareholders, these metrics help gauge returns and compare growth against benchmarks. Creditors utilize ratios to assess a company's repayment capacity and risks associated with leverage. Executives and managers rely on this analysis to optimize operations and effectively allocate capital. Today, it's vital to incorporate modern supplements, including industry metrics and broader contexts like market trends and regulations. As we explore the evolving landscape of financial analysis, integrating various elements is key. First, a holistic framework is essential, merging traditional ratios, dynamic KPIs, and ESG signals into one comprehensive view. Traditional ratios remain important, using income to sales for profitability and current assets to current liabilities for liquidity assessment. Additionally, dynamic KPIs like customer acquisition cost and churn rate help track growth efficiency. Lastly, ESG performance increasingly influences investor decisions, highlighting the importance of sustainability in today's market. Together, these elements create a robust decision-making context for investors, creditors, and managers. Understanding the practical applications of ratio analysis is essential for effective management decisions. For example, TCS benchmarks its return on assets against global peers like Accenture and IBM. This comparison helps assess asset efficiency, influencing key areas such as capital allocation. Meanwhile, Tesla tracks its debt-to-equity ratio to fund innovation while managing financial risks. Lastly, a mid-sized textile company observes a declining current ratio, indicating liquidity stress and prompting a focus on inventory management and payables discipline. Each scenario highlights the strategic importance of these financial metrics in the real world. Ratio analysis plays a vital role in understanding a company's financial health. It involves deriving relationships from financial statements to evaluate performance. This process transforms raw numbers into comparable decision-focused indicators. Core inputs like the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow are essential. Analysts use this data to identify trends, benchmark against peers, and ultimately assess financial health. Management, shareholders, lenders, and potential investors all rely on this analysis to make informed decisions. Understanding profitability is essential. It represents maximum profit in relation to risk and capital utilized effectively. Sales play a pivotal role, as factors like volume and pricing directly influence revenue potential. Next, we consider the cost of goods sold and how production efficiency affects gross margin on sales. Operating expenses must be controlled to transform that gross margin into sustainable operating profit. Finally, we evaluate profits against capital employed to assess true performance and make informed financial decisions. Understanding ROI, or return on capital employed, helps assess how effectively a company generates profit from its capital. It measures the operating profitability earned per unit of capital employed. Using profit before interest and tax provides a clear picture of operational performance. A higher ROI signals a more efficient use of long-term funds from owners and creditors. Comparing ROI with industry benchmarks enhances insight into operational effectiveness. The formula illustrates ROI as a percentage that supports meaningful comparisons over time, against peers, and within the industry. Let's delve into a practical example of calculating ROI. First, we identify our inputs. Profit before interest and tax is 240, and capital employed is 1200. Next, we apply the ROI formula and simplify it to obtain 0.2 as our decimal figure. To interpret this easily, we express it as a percentage, which gives us an ROI of 20%. This means the business is generating a return of 20% on the capital invested. Understanding capital employed is essential for financial analysis. Total assets encompass all resources, offering a comprehensive overview of business investments. On the other hand, total fixed assets zeroes in on long-term operational capacity, which is vital for asset-heavy industries. Long-term funds employed refines the perspective by focusing only on core operational financing. Lastly, fixed assets plus net working capital represent the total capital tied up in daily operations. Each interpretation of capital employed helps in evaluating financial performance accurately. Building on our previous discussion, let's explore the concept of return on shareholders' funds, or ROSF. This metric measures the earnings generated per unit of shareholders' funds, highlighting owner-centric profitability. It utilizes net profit after interest and tax, factoring in any net non-operating income. Shareholders' funds comprise equity share capital, preference share capital, plus all reserves and accumulated profits. A higher ROSF indicates better returns to owners, making it essential to compare this figure across years and industry peers for context. To calculate return on shareholders' funds, we first state the formula. It's based on profit after interest and tax, adding net non-operating income over shareholders' funds. Now for our example, we insert figures. The profit after interest and tax is 120, net non-operating income is 10, while total shareholders' funds amount to 750. We compute the ratio to gauge returns. This results in a 17.33%, suggesting strong owner returns, especially when compared to industry standards. Understanding return on equity, or ROE, is crucial for assessing a company's profitability. First, ROE uses profit after preference dividend, which reflects true earnings for equity holders. Next, we consider the equity shareholders' funds, which include equity share capital, reserves and profits, adjusting for any accumulated losses. ROE indicates the return being generated for equity holders. Higher returns are generally preferable. Remember, this measure helps illustrate how well management utilizes equity capital to create value for investors. Finally, the formula for ROE calculates profit relative to shareholder equity, emphasizing its importance in financial analysis. Let's explore a practical example of return on equity, or ROE. First, we identify equity earnings by removing the preference dividend from profit, isolating what belongs to equity holders. Thus, profit after tax is 500 minus a 50 preference dividend, resulting in 450. Next, we compute equity shareholders' funds from the balance sheet, totaling 2000. Finally, applying the ROE formula, we divide 450 by 2000 to find that the ROE is 22.5%, showing a solid return on equity. Understanding return on total assets, or ROA, is essential for evaluating asset efficiency. The purpose of ROA is to measure profit generated per unit of assets employed, focusing on productivity. It's crucial to determine the asset base by using average total assets and excluding fictitious ones like preliminary expenses. The operating approach divides EBIT by average productive total assets, emphasizing core operations. Alternatively, the net-based approach considers net profit after tax plus interest, assessing returns for all capital providers. A higher ROA indicates better asset utilization, and it's beneficial to compare this metric with past periods and industry peers. To understand the computation of return on assets, we first identify productive assets while removing any fictitious assets. This leads us to the formula for calculating average productive assets, which is the average total assets minus fictitious assets. Next, the operating approach utilizes EBIT over productive assets, showcasing how productive assets perform regardless of financing. Alternatively, the net-based approach adds back interest to profit after tax, offering a more comprehensive view for all capital providers. These methods provide valuable insights into asset efficiency. To deepen our understanding of return on assets, we'll start with a numerical illustration. Given that EBIT is 120, interest is 20, and the tax rate is 30%, with average total assets of 800 and fictitious assets of 40, we can compute productive assets. The calculation shows that average productive assets equals 760. Now we proceed to compute operating ROA, resulting in 15.79%. Finally, when calculating net-based ROA, we arrive at 11.84%. These computations provide crucial insights into asset performance. Understanding the gross profit ratio is essential for analyzing business performance. It showcases the link between gross profit and net sales, providing insight into margins before operating costs. A higher GPR indicates favorable outcomes, like a higher selling price or lower cost of goods sold. Conversely, a lower GPR can signal risks, such as increased costs or price cuts leading to low-margin products. It's crucial to ensure that the GPR is adequate to cover operating expenses and other financial obligations, such as interest and dividends. Understanding the gross profit ratio requires us to compute gross profit from sales and cost of goods sold. For instance, with net sales of 1 million and a cost of goods sold of 750,000, the gross profit becomes 250,000. Next, converting this to a percentage of net sales allows us to standardize profitability. Therefore, the gross profit ratio is 25%. Finally, analyzing this margin, we should ensure that it adequately covers operating expenses and fixed charges that total less than 25% of sales. Understanding the operating ratio is crucial for effective financial management. It represents the proportion of total operating expenses to net sales, which is sales minus returns. Included in this ratio are the costs directly tied to production, such as the cost of goods sold, administrative expenses, and selling and distribution costs. However, it's important to exclude finance expenses, like interest, as they do not pertain to operating activities. A lower operating ratio indicates higher operational efficiency, which is beneficial for the overall health of the business. From an investor's perspective, maintaining a low ratio is essential to ensure fair returns on their investments. Let's delve into an example of calculating the operating ratio. First, identify net sales and the operating cost components, while excluding finance costs such as interest. Next, sum up the operating expenses, which include the cost of goods sold, administrative expenses, and selling and distribution costs. Now, apply the operating ratio computation by dividing operating expenses by net sales and expressing it as a percentage. Finally, interpret the result. A lower percentage signals better efficiency and greater potential for investor returns. Understanding the operating profit ratio is essential for analyzing a company's performance. This ratio reveals the profit earned from core operations relative to sales, and higher values indicate greater efficiency. The formula for calculating this ratio is straightforward. Operating profit divided by sales multiplied by 100%. There are two ways to determine operating profit. This includes calculating net profit adjusted for non-operating expenses and incomes, or simply deducting operating expenses from gross profit. It's important to note that operating expenses entail administration, selling, and distribution costs, while finance expenses are generally excluded. Ultimately, this ratio is crucial, as it highlights routine operational efficiency, stripping away the impacts of non-operating factors. Operating profit is vital for understanding business health. Given sales of 1,000 and gross profit of 300, we subtract operating expenses of 120, yielding an operating profit of 180. Next, we confirm this using net profit, which is 185, adjusting for non-operating expenses of 5 and non-operating income of 10, still landing at 180. Now, we compute the operating profit ratio as a percentage of sales. 180 divided by 1000 gives us 18%. This means that 18% of every sales dollar comes from core operations, excluding finance expenses from operating costs. As we delve into expense ratios, let's explore their integral role in financial analysis. The administrative expenses ratio measures the proportion of administrative costs to net sales, highlighting efficiency. Next, the selling and distribution expenses ratio evaluates selling and distribution costs against net sales, a critical insight for businesses. The financial expenses ratio assesses financial burdens, like interest and bank charges, in relation to net sales. These ratios serve as support to the operating ratio, underlining how well specific cost pools are controlled. Additionally, similar calculations apply to other cost items such as direct materials and factory overheads, giving a comprehensive view of overall costs. Net profit ratio provides crucial insight into financial health. It shows the return to shareholders from sales, with higher values indicating better performance. This includes net profit, which adds non-operating income and profits. However, deductions for non-operating expenses and tax provisions must be considered. Ultimately, this ratio summarizes overall efficiency, reflecting how well a company manages its gains and charges. Understanding this metric helps gauge a firm's profitability in comparison to its net sales. To understand the net profit ratio, we first find net sales by adjusting for returns or allowances, resulting in net sales of 950. Next, we compute net profit by adding non-operating income and subtracting non-operating expenses and tax, giving us a net profit of 100. Then we apply the ratio formula, which translates to a net profit ratio of approximately 10.53%. This figure is crucial, as it highlights the company's efficiency at converting sales into profit. By evaluating this ratio, we can gain insight into how well the company is managing its resources. Earnings per share, or EPS, is crucial in understanding owner-centric success, as it represents the profit attributable to equity shareholders. Additionally, higher EPS often underpins higher share valuations in the market, signaling strength to investors. It also reflects a company's capacity to distribute earnings as dividends, which is vital for income-focused investors. To compute EPS, we take net profit after tax, subtract preference dividends, and divide by the total number of equity shares. This metric has become an essential staple for investors, providing a glimpse into a company's financial health and potential for growth. Understanding earnings per share, or EPS, is crucial for assessing a company's financial health. We start with the standard definition, isolating earnings for equity holders, and identifying the share count for precise per-share scaling. Next, let's apply some sample figures that will help us compute our per-share earnings seamlessly. Given that net profit after tax is 120, the preference dividend is 20, and we have 50 shares outstanding. Finally, by calculating EPS, we subtract the preference dividend from the net profit after tax and divide by the number of shares, resulting in an EPS of 2. Let's explore the price-earnings ratio, a vital tool in financial analysis. The P/E ratio indicates how many times earnings investors are paying for a share. To calculate it, you'll need the market price per share and the earnings per share. Investors use this ratio to assess the attractiveness of a stock at its market price. A higher PE suggests growth expectations, while a lower PE may indicate undervaluation. Always compare this ratio against industry peers and historical data before making investment decisions. To calculate the price-earnings ratio, we start by identifying the inputs. We use the market price per share, divided by earnings per share, known as EPS. In our example, with a price of $150 and an EPS of $10, we can compute the ratio. When we substitute these values, we find that the PE ratio equals 15. A PE of 15 indicates that investors are willing to pay 15 times the company's EPS at its current price. This connection illustrates the market's expectation for earnings from the company. As we move into the topic of payout ratio, it's essential to understand what it shows. This ratio reflects the portion of profit paid out to shareholders as dividends. We measure it through two key formulas, dividend per share divided by earnings per share, or total dividends divided by total earnings, both multiplied by 100. This insight also speaks to company policy. A higher payout suggests less retention of earnings, while a lower payout indicates more reinvestment into the business. Moreover, the payout ratio combined with the retained earnings ratio equals 100%, establishing a crucial link between the two. Finally, analyzing this ratio helps assess a company's dividend policy's impact on growth and shareholder cash flow. Understanding the payout ratio with practical figures helps clarify its relevance. First, we assume earnings per share of 10 and dividends per share of 4, with total earnings at 5 million and total dividends at 2 million. Next, computing the payout ratio using the per share formula gives us a ratio of 40%. To verify, we can check the payout using totals, which also indicates 40%. This leads to a significant interpretation. The retained earnings ratio is 60%, meaning the firm prioritizes reinvestment. The retained earnings ratio plays a key role in understanding a company's profit allocation. This ratio represents the share of the current year's net profit that is retained rather than distributed as dividends. You can calculate it using two equivalent formulas, either the percentage of profit retained or by subtracting the payout ratio from 100. It complements the payout ratio, ensuring both add up to a full allocation of profits. Additionally, there's a policy note that mandates a firm must retain at least 20% of net profit before declaring any dividends. Let's dive into a quick calculation of retention versus payout. Given that the net profit after tax is 1 million rupees and dividends declared are 600,000 rupees, we compute the payout ratio. This gives us a payout of 60%. By using the complementarity principle, we can then find the retention ratio, which amounts to 40%. We confirm this by calculating retained earnings, which show 400,000 rupees for the current year. Finally, we cross-check our formulas to ensure they are consistent and verify that payout plus retention equals 100%. Understanding interest cover, also known as fixed charges cover, is essential for assessing financial stability. It measures how many times profit can cover fixed interest obligations. The primary components include EBIT, which stands for earnings before interest and tax, divided by fixed interest charges. A higher ratio indicates a lower risk, providing a stronger cushion for lenders. This metric is vital for debenture holders and long-term lenders, who seek reassurances about a company's debt servicing capability. To understand interest cover, we begin by identifying the inputs clearly. We'll use operating profit before interest and tax, known as EBIT, and the total fixed interest for the period. In our example, EBIT is 600 and the interest is 150. Next, we compute the interest cover by dividing EBIT by fixed interest charges, revealing that our coverage is 4 times. This higher multiple implies lower risk for creditors and more room to raise debt. Thus, a 4.0 times cover reflects a strong capacity to meet interest obligations comfortably. To grasp the essence of the dividend yield ratio, we begin by understanding its significance. It shows the cash return per rupee of share price, providing valuable insights for investors. This ratio is particularly useful when screening for dividend income and assessing payout stability. However, it's essential to compare yields wisely within the same industry and consider varying payout policies. The formula expresses dividend yield as a percentage of the share's current market price, revealing critical information for income-focused investors. In essence, this enables them to compare immediate cash returns across different securities effectively. To understand dividend yield, we first identify our inputs. We use the latest annual cash dividend per share of 6 rupees and the market price per share of 120 rupees. Next, we apply the dividend yield formula to connect the dividend to the market value. This calculation reveals that the dividend yield is 5%. Thus, an investor who purchases at this market price can expect a 5% return annually before any consideration such as price change or taxes. Let's delve into turnover ratios, which indicate how frequently key resources cycle through operations. They are calculated relative to sales or cost of sales, helping us understand resource usage effectively. A higher turnover implies brisk activity and efficient working capital management. Managers often utilize these ratios to oversee areas such as inventory movement and asset productivity. Common examples include inventory turnover and debtors turnover, all crucial for informed financial decisions. Understanding the inventory turnover ratio is essential for assessing how efficiently a business manages its stock. This ratio measures the cost of goods sold against the average inventory, providing insights into inventory usage. Average stock is calculated as the mean of opening and closing stock for the period. For trading entities, COGS is determined by adding opening stock to purchases and direct expenses before subtracting closing stock. In manufacturing, COGS includes total production costs, adjusting for finished goods as well. When gross profit is known, we can calculate COGS by subtracting gross profit from sales, with higher turnover signaling more efficient operations over time. Let's dive into the process of computing inventory turnover. First, compute the cost of goods sold using the trading formula. Cost of goods sold equals opening stock plus purchases and expenses minus closing stock, which gives us 300. Next, we find the average stock by taking the opening and closing stock values, calculating an average of 60. Finally, calculate the inventory turnover by dividing the cost of goods sold by the average stock, resulting in 5 times. This indicates how efficiently the inventory is being managed. Understanding stock velocity is essential for efficient inventory management. It shows the average time inventory stays before it's sold or used. By converting turnover into a days expression, we can assess the turnover on a yearly basis. Similarly, representing turnover in months gives us a clearer picture over a 12-month time frame. A lower number of days or months indicates faster stock velocity, which is crucial for reducing holding costs. Ultimately, the managerial goal is to increase this velocity by minimizing the holding period. To better understand the practical implications of turnover rates, let's begin with the days formula. By plugging in our turnover of 5 times, we find that the average holding period is 73 days. Next, we convert that same turnover into months using the months formula, which gives us approximately 2.4 months. It's beneficial to cross-check our calculations by converting the days back to months, reaffirming that 73 days also approximates to 2.4 months. Finally, for management action, this indicates that we should aim to reduce this period, thereby increasing inventory velocity. Understanding debtors' turnover is crucial for effective financial management. This ratio quantifies how many times receivables rotate within a given period, reflecting collection efficiency. To calculate it, divide credit sales by average trade receivables. If average figures are unavailable, closing receivables can serve as an imperfect proxy. However, be cautious, as using closing data might inflate perceptions of turnover if year-end collections are strong. A higher turnover indicates enhanced liquidity, underscoring the importance of effective accounts receivable management. Let's dive deeper into understanding debtors' turnover and average collection period. Start by using the preferred formula with period average receivables to accurately gauge performance. Next, input the data. Credit sales equal 12 lakh rupees with opening trade receivables at 2,40,000 and closing trade receivables at 1,60,000. Computing these gives us an average trade receivables of 2 lakh rupees and a debtors turnover ratio of 6 times. Now translating this turnover into an average collection period, we find it to be approximately 60 days. Finally, comparing this with a closing balance proxy reveals an overstatement, making it crucial to be aware of the biased outlook it can provide. Understanding the creditor's turnover is essential for assessing efficiency in managing payables. It signifies how often payables rotate within a year. This is influenced by key drivers like the purchase policy, purchase volume, and suppliers' credit policies. The calculation involves net credit purchases, which are derived by subtracting purchase returns from total credit purchases. Moreover, to gauge the average accounts payable, we take the mean of opening and closing accounts payable balances. Finally, interpreting these metrics reveals that a higher turnover indicates delayed payments, while a lower turnover reflects prompt settlements aligned with liquidity needs. To ensure efficient calculations, we will first find the net credit purchases. Subtracting purchase returns from credit purchases gives us this value. Next, we compute the average accounts payable by averaging the opening and closing balances. With these metrics, we then calculate the creditor's turnover to understand our payment cycles. Finally, we convert this turnover into the average payment period in days for strategic financial planning. Understanding the working capital turnover ratio is crucial for effective financial management. This ratio measures how efficiently working capital supports sales operations. The formula for calculating it is simple: cost of sales divided by net working capital. To determine net working capital, you subtract current liabilities from current assets. A higher ratio indicates lower working capital investment and potentially higher profits, but excessive sales may lead to overtrading. Conversely, a low ratio could signal undertrading where cash is inefficiently tied up. Let's explore the practical application by computing the working capital turnover. First, we compute net working capital from current assets and liabilities, arriving at a value of 200. Next, applying the turnover formula with a cost of sales of 1000, we find the working capital turnover is 5.0 times. This indicates an efficient use of resources. However, it's crucial to monitor for signs of overtrading as higher values impact sustainability. Understanding fixed assets turnover ratio is essential for appraising how efficiently fixed assets are utilized for generating profits. It evaluates the relationship between costs of sales and fixed assets, reflecting operational efficiency. Preferred formulations include dividing costs of sales by fixed assets or sales by net fixed assets, which accounts for depreciation. To gain accurate insights, always use average balances of assets over the period. A higher ratio indicates better utilization, while a lower ratio suggests possible underutilization. Finally, comparing these ratios against industry peers and historical data enhances your analysis. To better appreciate fixed assets turnover, let's dive into some practical calculations. First, we have sales of 1,200 and cost of sales at 900, along with average fixed assets of 750 and average net fixed assets of 600. We compute the cost-based FATR, which reveals that the company generates 1.2 units of cost throughput per unit of fixed assets. Shifting to sales-based FATR, we find that revenue intensity per net asset book value stands at 2. Higher ratios indicate better asset utilization, while lower ratios could mean underutilization, reinforcing the importance of comparing these figures against industry standards and historical trends. Understanding the capital turnover ratio is essential for evaluating business performance. It indicates how effectively capital generates sales, with higher ratios signifying better efficiency. Next, capital employed can be viewed as a sum of shareholders, funds, and long-term loans, or calculated as total assets minus current liabilities. For a deeper insight, the owned capital turnover ratio compares sales or cost of sales against shareholders' funds. In contrast, total capital turnover measures the same against all capital employed. This helps businesses assess how well they utilize their financial resources. Now that we've looked at capital turnover concepts, let's apply them practically. First, compute capital employed from both the financing and asset perspectives for accuracy. This establishes your capital turnover base. Next, determine owned capital turnover using sales figures to evaluate equity efficiency, rounding to 2 decimals for clarity. Then calculate the total capital turnover to examine how well all capital generates sales. Finally, consider using cost of sales for a stricter assessment, which typically results in a lower ratio. Understanding solvency ratios is essential for grasping a company's financial health. These ratios, drawn from the balance sheet, reflect both financial position and solvency. Start with an overall solvency perspective to gauge total debt burden and safety margin. Moving to short-term analysis, assess current and liquid assets to evaluate near-term payment capacity. For long-term sustainability, examine fixed assets and capital structure to understand risk ratios. Lastly, remember that different stakeholders, including creditors and investors, interpret solvency measures uniquely based on their interests. Understanding the total debt ratio is crucial for evaluating a company's financial strategy. This ratio represents the proportion of tangible assets financed through borrowed funds. It combines short-term and long-term debt to reflect total liabilities while comparing them to total tangible assets. A higher ratio indicates greater leverage and risk, potentially making it harder to secure additional financing. It's essential to assess this ratio in conjunction with other liquidity and long-term metrics to gauge overall solvency comprehensively. Understanding the total debt ratio creates a clearer picture of financial health. First, we identify inputs from the balance sheet. Total borrowings are 300 and tangible assets total 500. Next, we compute the ratio, revealing that 60% of assets are financed by debt. This indicates higher leverage, which can heighten financial risk. Finally, interpreting this result shows potential difficulties in future borrowing due to lower owner safety. Understanding short-term solvency is crucial for assessing a company's financial health. The primary aim is to gauge a firm's ability to meet its current obligations using cash-like resources against short-term liabilities. We begin with the current ratio, which compares current assets to current liabilities, providing insight into the overall short-term buffer. Next, the liquid or quick ratio emphasizes the assets that can be quickly converted to cash, excluding inventories for a tighter view. Finally, the cash position ratio zooms in on cash and equivalents against immediate payables, reflecting the company's most liquid position. This analysis supports creditors and managers in making informed decisions on liquidity and cash management. Let's dive deeper into financial analysis, starting with the current ratio. The formula for the current ratio is current assets divided by current liabilities. Current assets include debtors, stock, bills receivable, cash, bank balances, prepaid expenses, income due, and short-term investments. In contrast, current liabilities consist of creditors, bank overdraft, bills payable, outstanding expenses, and income received in advance. This ratio serves a crucial purpose by indicating a company's ability to pay its near-term obligations as they become due. By understanding this metric, businesses can better manage their financial health and liquidity. To evaluate the current ratio, begin by listing and totaling current assets. In this example, the total current assets equal 400. Next, list the current liabilities which total 250. By applying the formula, you divide the current assets by the current liabilities, resulting in 1.6. This signifies the company's asset liquidity, indicating it possesses 1.6 rupees of current assets for every 1 rupee of liability. Understanding the standard expected current ratio of 2:1 is crucial for financial health. This means that current assets are roughly twice the current liabilities, providing a safety net for liquidity. It's preferred as it offers the flexibility to manage obligations, even if current assets take a hit. The composition of these assets matters. A focus on cash and receivables enhances liquidity compared to inventories. However, excessively high ratios can indicate inefficiencies in idle funds. Lastly, relying heavily on costly long-term financing for short-term needs may signal underlying issues. Understanding the quick or acid test ratio is essential for assessing immediate financial health. This ratio compares quick assets, which are current assets excluding stock and prepaid expenses, to current liabilities. A benchmark of approximately 1 is considered prudent for maintaining liquidity. When analyzing the gap between the quick and current ratios, it can reveal potential problems with inventory management. Creditors use this ratio to gauge a company's ability to meet short-term obligations without relying on selling inventory. To compute and interpret the quick ratio, we start by identifying key inputs. Gather the current assets, inventory, prepaid expenses, and current liabilities. Next, we compute quick assets by excluding inventory and prepaid expenses. After calculating quick assets, we divide this by current liabilities to find the quick ratio. An optional step is to compute the current ratio for comparison, which helps identify any issues related to inventory. Finally, interpret the results. A quick ratio below 1, paired with a higher current ratio, suggests liquidity issues tied up in inventory. Understanding the cash position ratio is essential for assessing liquidity. This ratio captures only cash and near-cash assets against short-term obligations, excluding inventory and receivables. It's especially useful during tight liquidity assessments or stress scenarios to check your financial health. A higher cash position ratio indicates a stronger immediate pay capacity, while an extremely high ratio may suggest underutilized cash resources. Key inputs include cash, cash equivalents, marketable securities, and current liabilities. Remember, this ratio isolates absolute liquid assets, giving a precise snapshot of pay now strength. To compute the cash position ratio, first sum your absolute liquid assets. This includes cash, cash equivalents, and marketable securities, which total 100. Next, confirm your short-term obligations or current liabilities, which amount to 200. Applying the formula gives a cash position ratio of 0.5. This means for every 1 unit of short-term liabilities, only half is covered by immediate liquidity. Understanding this ratio is crucial for your financial decision-making. As we explore long-term solvency, it's essential to assess how long-term funds support assets. This analysis balances risk and sustainability for stakeholders. Next, consider how fixed assets should be backed by stable long-term sources. It's critical to gauge leverage and the risk sharing between creditors and owners over time. Another vital aspect involves examining the proportion of owners' funds that support total assets. Lastly, understanding the mix of fixed cost capital versus equity can help us evaluate its effect on earnings sensitivity. Fixed assets ratio provides insight into how long-term funds are allocated to fixed assets after accounting for depreciation. It comprises net fixed assets calculated by subtracting depreciation from fixed assets and long-term funds, which include share capital, reserves, and loans, minus fictitious assets. Typically, this ratio should remain under 1, ideally around 0.67. A ratio below 1 indicates that long-term funds are contributing to core working capital, which is a positive sign. Conversely, exceeding 1 highlights potential risks, as it suggests reliance on short-term funds for financing fixed assets, which can compromise financial stability. To dive deeper, let's compute the fixed assets ratio step by step. First, find the net fixed assets by subtracting accumulated depreciation from gross fixed assets, resulting in net fixed assets of 800 rupees. Next, compute the long-term funds by adding only stable sources and excluding fictitious assets, leading to 1150 rupees. Now, apply the formula to get the fixed assets ratio by dividing net fixed assets by long-term funds, yielding a ratio of 0.7. Finally, interpret this result. A ratio of 0.7 indicates that part of the core working capital is prudently funded by long-term sources. Understanding the debt-equity ratio is essential for grasping a company's financial health. It reflects the leverage and risk mix between outsiders, funds and owners, funds over the long term. External equities consist of all outsiders, liabilities, while internal equities focus on equity shareholders, funds. A benchmark of approximately 1:1 is ideal. Exceeding 1 indicates higher leverage, while less than 1 suggests more conservative financing. This ratio serves as a valuable assessment of long-term solvency. Let's delve into computing the debt-equity ratio, an important indicator of financial health. First, identify the necessary components from the balance sheet: long-term borrowings amounting to 600 rupees and equity shareholders, funds totaling 900 rupees. Next, apply the popular formula for assessing long-term solvency, which expresses the ratio as long-term borrowings divided by owners' funds. After calculations, you'll find that this yields a leverage measure of 0.67. Finally, represent this as a ratio of 0.67:1, which indicates a lower dependence on debt compared to the benchmark of 1:1. Understanding the proprietary ratio is essential in assessing a company's financial health. This ratio compares shareholders' funds to total tangible assets, indicating the overall soundness of the business. The formula is straightforward. Proprietary ratio equals shareholders' funds divided by total tangible assets. Creditors pay close attention to this metric, as it reflects how much of the assets are financed by the owners. A high proprietary ratio suggests greater security for lenders, while a low ratio signals increased risk. If the ratio falls below 5, it raises alarms about heavy reliance on creditor funds and potential issues during liquidation. In financial analysis, the capital gearing ratio is crucial. It shows the proportion of non-owners' funds against owners' funds, illustrating the leverage within a company's capital structure. The formula is simple. Divide fixed interest and dividend-bearing funds by equity shareholders' funds. High gearing indicates reliance on debt, suggesting financial strain, while low gearing reflects an equity-heavy structure, which may lead to underused capital. The aim is to pursue fair capitalization, ensuring a balanced approach to financing. Now let's explore trends analysis for ABC Limited. First, from 2012 to 2015, sales skyrocketed by 22%, creating notable momentum post-2013. The year 2013 marked a pivotal moment with a 16% sales increase aligned with the export launch. Furthermore, operating leverage is clear as costs have remained steady, while profit margins improved around 10% annually. Additionally, Surya Fertilizer showcases receivables efficiency, where sales increased 22% against an 8% rise in debtors. Consequently, the days sales outstanding improved from 60 to just 53 days, demonstrating enhanced cash flow management. Let's consolidate what we've learned about financial analysis for management decisions. Financial analysis is essential for evaluating a company's overall health and supporting effective management decisions. We explored key ratio categories: profitability, activity and solvency, offering insights into efficiency, liquidity and stability. Understanding ratio formulas and interpretations is vital for making accurate financial assessments. Additionally, we examine modern applications and trends, including trend analysis and ESG metrics, enhancing the relevance of financial analysis today. You can apply these principles to real-world financial evaluations and strategic planning.